The Church of God the Eternal presents A Picture of Paradise, the third message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Why Keep the Feast, given for the afternoon service of the third day of the Feast of Tabernacles in Townsend, Tennessee, October 19th, 2024.
So this festival, I'm challenging you with the question, why keep the feast? Simple question. And there are relatively simple answers to that question, why keep the feast? But hopefully it's not too simple. It's not too simplistic that we avoid gaining some real benefit from it. That's my hope, is that we take simple questions and an opportunity to reaffirm the reason that we're here, the reason we think the way that we do and for what we are choosing to do, like in coming together. It's an incredible sacrifice in order to come out of your normal lives back home, to make a journey, many cases for you, long distances, and to be here for an entire eight-day festival. There's got to be some reason that you do it. And I'm just exploring now all of the possible reasons that account for what it is that we're doing. So I started on the opening night just to inform, well, of course, we do it because God said so. And I went back through the basic biblical texts which support the fact that these annual Sabbaths, as well as the weekly Sabbath, are real and they have not been done away. And so that's, if you want to say, probably the number one reason I think most of us would say, why do you do that? Because God said so. And then on the first tie day, I actually backed up a step and said, well, why do you care about something called a God? You know, so God said so, that's why you do it. But what's your concept of God? So we went back and explored our belief about a real and active, howbeit invisible, being who created all that exists and then made the rules for the way that everything works in the universe. And how our belief in that one true, real creator God compares to the concepts in the world about God, if God, what God, and what it is he's doing, if anything. So hopefully we have a foundation. We believe that there is a God and that we are accountable to him, that he has expectations of us. And so then we keep the feast because he told us to. Well, what else? Well, here we are keeping the weekly Sabbath now that falls during this annual Festival of Tabernacles. And so in essence, we have now a holy day within the festival. And it just so happens that the weekly Sabbath also pictures the thousand-year millennial reign of Jesus Christ, just like this whole seven-day Feast of Tabernacles does. So in essence, we have not just the first high day of Tabernacles, which we kept a couple of days ago, but now we have a weekly Sabbath within the feast, which also pictures that thousand-year reign of Jesus Christ, which will begin his dominion upon this earth. I say because when Jesus Christ begins to rule, there will never, ever be another king. He will be the last king that reigns. So I always think of the millennium as the first thousand years of his eternal rulership in concert with his Father's will. So what's another reason now to keep the Feast of Tabernacles? I'm going to say it's because we cherish what that feast pictures in God's plan. And so today, this morning, I'm going to go through a lot of the basic text in the Bible that you know very, very well, which describes the physical dominion of Jesus Christ upon this earth during that thousand-year reign. What is going to happen when Jesus Christ takes possession of this earth, supplants every human government and the invisible enemy, Satan the devil, who up until this point has been ruling within the will of God, but he's going to be removed and set aside. Jesus Christ is going to become the new king. He is now going to establish his reign upon this earth. What is that going to look like? And what changes are going to take place because of a new regime? So we're going to go through basically this morning the physical changes that take place upon the earth and in the structure of government upon this earth. So the first thing we want to know or take note of is the fact that the evils of this world under man's rule are going to come to a close. And boy, is that going to be something to celebrate. Let's start in Genesis 3, verse 17. Because here we read that there were certain curses that were introduced to this earth because of the sin of Adam and Eve and their children down through the ages, which you and I are all a part of, because we all go back to that same original set of parents. But it's easy to take for granted the way things exist in the environment, in the ecology, in the substance of this current earth, because it's always been as long as we've lived and as long as our ancestors have lived. And yet, there are things which are not going to be that way when Christ rules. Genesis 3, verse 17 says, unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened to the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake. So here was an introduction of some kind of curse upon the ground, which didn't really exist before. Meaning when God first reformed the earth, made it beautiful as Genesis 1 and 2 show, and then put Adam and Eve upon it, it was a beautiful paradise. Now after man sinned, God made some changes physically and introduced some curses. What were they? Cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. So God is confirming you're going to grow your food out of the ground. You know, the source of everything you need to live as human beings and as families is going to come out of the earth, and it does. But what he told him is, but because of your sins, it's going to be hard. It's not going to be easy to grow your food and to have everything that you need. You're going to have to work extra hard, and you're going to have to suffer because of sin. Cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. And yet there's a lot of people today who love the agrarian environment, and if you're not a farmer, would love to be a farmer. I'm not one of those, but I understand it. I understand the idea of the satisfaction that comes from managing your own land and tilling the ground and planting and reaping and doing all of that. And I have incredible respect for those who have that orientation of mind. It's just not mine. Now, maybe if it was the kind of original environment that God intended, maybe I'd feel differently about it. But I'm always amazed and gratified by those who are willing to put up with all of the disadvantages and the hardships in order to grow food and to manage those kind of estates in order to bring forth something of value to human beings. But here we said, in sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Verse 18, thorns also in thistles shall it bring forth to thee. So how many of you have ever stopped to think that dealing with weeds was not an original requirement? The thorns and the thistles and the weeds that fight against those who are trying to plant and to reap food was an added curse. It wasn't the way God originally planned it to be, which is the first thing to tell you under the rule of Jesus Christ. When the curses are all removed, no more weeds. What a concept. That's going to be real. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground. For out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return. So mankind brought upon himself the death penalty, but also more hardship while they are alive in order to work, to have the things that they need just to survive. God would provide what they needed, and he has. For nearly 6,000 years now, the human family has been toiling and receiving the sustenance that they need, but it's under great hardship. So that's a big change that's going to happen. That curse is going to be removed. Leviticus 18, verse 25. The land is defiled. This is how God inspired through Moses to write concerning the state of affairs, again, because of the misbehavior of human beings who break his law. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of everything that's involved in defiling of the land. The number one, I would tell you, the easy one to identify is the fact that human beings violate the land Sabbath requirement. So there was one of the laws that he confirmed through ancient Israel that every 7 years they needed to rest their land completely and not sow upon it. And human beings don't follow that. So what do they do instead? Because in essence, they sap the life out of the earth, which means over ensuing number of years, it stops producing quality crops. So how does man overcome that? Fertilizer. Along with, you know, the weed killers, the fertilizers, in order to force the land to produce. But it's an artificial endeavor which never produces the quality of the food that it should, the earth should reap. And so the land is cursed, and it is cursed today. Now, organic farming and all that is good, and but you know, it takes a lot of effort, and a lot of those godly principles actually are more closely adhered to with organic processes. But in general, what man does with the land is in violation of the rules that God gave. The land is defiled, therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. In whatever way, in essence, human beings are forced off the land becomes a curse to human beings rather than a blessing, because human beings will not follow God's instruction on how to take care of it. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, he said to Israel, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nation, for any stranger that sojourns among you. Of course, it applies more broadly in religious worship, avoiding idolatry, but it's all part of the same ideology that human beings have when they decide to take what God commanded and say, I have a better idea. I'm going to use my own judgment to decide what's good and what's evil, and how to worship, what to worship, and how to take care of the land. And it is a curse, and human beings then bring upon their own heads all of these abominations because of the violation of God's law. Verse 27, for all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled. So now when you're talking about the coming kingdom of Jesus Christ, the millennium we're celebrating during this feast, and in particular on this weekly Sabbath during the feast, you're talking about a time when all of those curses are going to be lifted. After 6,000 years of curse, that's going to be lifted by God. And instead, the earth will be returned to its pristine state to be a true blessing to human beings and the families that will be raised in the ensuing 1,000 years. Verse 28, that the land spew not you. So he warned Israel. He said, don't behave like all these nations around you. That the land spew not you out also when you defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you. Other text I won't turn to. Ultimately, when God sent Israel into captivity, the northern kingdom by the Assyrians, and then about 150, 60 years later, the southern kingdom of Judah under the Babylonians, God says specifically, now the land will rest. In other words, so the Israelites wouldn't follow his rules and they wouldn't obey the land Sabbath laws. Well, so he took them off the land. In essence, most of that land of Palestine then did rest because it didn't have people on it. So God is going to make sure sooner or later that those rules are followed and respected, whether human beings will be good stewards or not. And so that is a historical warning to say, if we don't do what we're supposed to do it, he'll remove us, and then he'll make sure whatever happens afterward will obey his law. One more here, Jeremiah 12, verse 4. Jeremiah 12, verse 4 says, how long shall the land mourn? Well, dirt doesn't really mourn. It doesn't have emotions. But poetically speaking, that's how God speaks about the problems, the difficulties, the rebellion, and the ensuing curses that come because of man's mismanagement of the land. How long shall the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither? Why? For the wickedness of them that dwell therein. The beasts are consumed and the birds because they said, he shall not see our last end. Meaning human beings discount God or their accountability toward God, and they say, we'll do what we want to while God is not looking. At least that's the way they think. And so they destroy it all. This makes me think about the number of places in the world where literally the animals and the birds have all disappeared. So on one side, we know, you know, the environmentalists and the ecologists go to an opposite extreme of wanting to keep all the land wild and consider human beings as a parasite. So we should, you know, like we're the ones who harm the earth, so we should stay, not use the earth at all. Okay, that's one extreme. That comes from Satan. On the other extreme are the environments upon this planet where human beings just take everything that they want, and there is no environmental management, which means the animals and the birds, the fish, all disappear. And so there are a number of nations around the world that absolutely exploit the natural resources. So I hate using the environmentalist terms like sustainability, but it really is a godly principle. When God's rules are followed, human beings can have the riches that come out of the natural resources of the earth, but not take away its ability to continue to produce in the future. But it takes following godly principles in order to do it. So for instance, the Mediterranean Sea virtually has no fish, because the Europeans and the Africans have basically exploited it. There's just not much, you know, ecological life in the ocean there or in the sea. There are places in Asia, like in China, you just don't see wildlife. You've seen probably, you know, descriptions of North Korea. There's no birds. There's no squirrels. The people are starving so much they eat them all. So I don't know. Those are just probably not the implication of this in Jeremiah 12:4, but it certainly crosses my mind when it says the beasts are consumed and the birds because they said he shall not see our last end. Man follows his own rules, his way, and destroys the earth and the environment. The rulership of Jesus Christ is going to bring a time of peace and blessing, and the earth itself is going to be restored to its original pristine condition to be a blessing to human beings. Here's a citation from Mr. Herbert Armstrong from his booklet from the 1960s entitled The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. Just one statement he made here, which I thought was very good. He said, quote, God marked out 6 millennial days to allow man to indulge in the spiritual labor of sin, followed by a millennium of spiritual rest under the enforced government of God. So there's a whole lot in that short statement, but I think it's very well said. He's given man 6,000 years to abuse and exploit and to take advantage and to pollute the earth, but it's going to be followed by a 1,000-year period under Jesus Christ where the land will rest. By comparison to those first 6,000 years, now it doesn't mean, obviously there's going to be farming and there's going to be, and human beings and families in every nation around the globe are going to use the land, but they're going to use it according to the law of God, which means that there's going to be a much bounty that is produced. But by comparison of the first 6,000 years, it's going to be as if the earth gets its land Sabbath finally. Because things are going to be done according to the laws of God. But Jesus Christ is going to enforce it, which is what it means that he's going to rule with a rod of iron. He's not going to allow human beings to depart from his rules and to exploit and to abuse. Those principles will be fulfilled under his kingdom. Joel 2, verse 28. Joel 2, verse 28 says, "It shall come to pass afterward." So we're talking about all of the events leading up to the end of the age, which I described to you in my sermon on the Feast of Trumpets. "It shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh." So this is the time in which all human beings upon the earth are going to have their minds opened with a calling and an opportunity to come into a close relationship with God. Right now, they don't have that. Only a very few of which you are a part of have had this special miracle to have your mind open so that you can understand it, let alone then to answer God's call and to choose to follow him. But for the most part, the people of the world, they don't. They are blinded intentionally by God, which is, by the way, another one of those key doctrines which separates the true church of God from all of these other Christian, quote-unquote, denominations out there. They don't believe that. In fact, they think you're hateful if you believe that. They think all human beings have salvation open to them right now. It's just a matter of going out and doing missionary work and getting them all to say the magic words, "I accept Jesus Christ as my Savior." Not so. The Bible is full of confirmations that you must be called. So again, they quote John 3:16, but they never quote John 6:44. "No man can come unto me except the Father which sent me draw him." They don't quote that one. But it's all a part of God's perfect plan. There's a reason in love that he's not calling everybody now. In the day that Christ begins to rule, then all people will be called, which is what in part we celebrated on the Day of Atonement. The time when reconciliation for every member of the human family is going to have a chance to have that relationship that is offered to you right now. And here is another description. "It shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy." Doesn't mean they're all given the capacity to tell you what's going to happen in the future. This word prophesy means to speak in an inspired manner. Ones who are inspired by the Holy Spirit have an opportunity then to respond and to behave and to think and to speak spiritually rather than carnally. "Your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions, and also upon the servants and upon the handmaidens in those days while I pour out my spirit." So this is talking about the time in the millennial reign of Jesus Christ when salvation is offered to every single human being. Verse 30 now it says, "And I will show wonders in heavens and earth." It doesn't say thereafter. Could be thereafter. Could be this is harkens back now to those events in the end of our age leading up to it. But it says, "I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord to come." That seems to hearken back to the events leading up to the beginning of the millennium. Verse 32, "And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Eternal shall be delivered. And in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance, as the Eternal hath said, and in the remnant whom the Eternal shall call." Isaiah 11, verse 1. We're looking at the major changes that are going to happen upon this earth once Jesus Christ begins to rule, once he ushers in his millennial reign. Isaiah 1 or 11, beginning in verse 1, "There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And the spirit of the eternal shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the eternal." Verse 3, "And shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of the eternal. He shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked." All right, let's pick that apart. What do we find is going to happen? Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a king, a sovereign Lord who rules, who actually, number one, is wise, who actually knows something and has the wisdom to know how to make good decisions on behalf of the people? Do we have that now? Are you happy with your government? How much would it be worth to have a government structure, one that had knowledge and then had the wisdom and the wherewithal to actually apply it for the good of the people? What a concept. And I'm not going off on a tangent on politics, but if you think in 2 or 3 weeks there's a chance that you might get a president in the United States who might, ain't gonna happen. Because there's not any human being in this world right now who can solve the problems of the world. There's some who probably would do better than others, and I can't kind of help but kind of root for that myself. I understand it. But you know better, because you're the people of God and you understand the only solution for the problems of this world is going to be the kingdom under Jesus Christ. There is no human government anywhere on the earth, including the USA, that has a chance to fix the problems here or abroad. So that's all a pipe dream. That's a potential deception waiting, trying to trap you and to trap me into thinking or hoping for it or desiring it. And I hate to be a pessimist, but your best program is to assume the worst. Because if what's going to happen is exactly what Jesus Christ said, and we've already been through that, the worst is coming. I don't know how we're going to get from A to Z, but we know what's going to occur, and it's going to be kind of evil, tribulation, persecution, and abominations like have never existed in the last 6,000 years. For some of you, it will happen in your lifetime. So that's where we're headed. We're all on a rocket ride to oblivion if Jesus Christ does not intervene and stop it. And there's no politician, no matter how good his words are, is going to turn that away. But here now you're talking what the passage I just read to you through verse 5 is the time when you will get a government upon this earth that is wise and is fair and is equitable. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a government where the meek, the weakest upon the earth would get just as much justice, quote unquote, as the wealthy and the well-connected? How would that be for an idea? It's not about how much money or power or influence you have to get good things. The weakest and the least influential will get equity and justice from government. How would that be? Wouldn't that be marvelous? When you've got a government, when you've got a king, you've got a government structure that's actually looking out, truly looking out for the weak and the poor, not just using it as a political byline. in order to turn around and exploit. Under Jesus Christ, it's going to be an equitable government from the top down. And all peoples and all nations around the globe under his rule will be blessed. Government will no longer be a curse like it is today and has been for nearly 6,000 years. It's going to absolutely be a blessing for the benefit of every nation and every family and every person. That's what's being described here. Verse 5, righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. Now, I'm not going to read verse 6 through 8 because we're going to come back to that in a little bit. So skip over that, but let's drop down to verse 9 for the moment. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. All these forces which exist in the world today under Satan the devil and under the auspices of greedy, exploitive, human beings who are liars, cheats, and deceivers. All that's going to be gone. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the eternal as the waters cover the sea. Right now, you've got to try and hunt to try and find truth. How easy it is to find truth or equity or somebody just being honest. Virtually impossible. Now we're describing a time under the rule of Jesus Christ, which is coming, when that truth and that equity and that honesty is going to be everywhere, because it's going to be the very fabric of his kingdom. Verse 10, and in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people, speaking of Jesus Christ himself. To it shall the Gentile see. Who is a Gentile? One cut off from God. Because now these are ones who formerly were Gentiles. And that means regardless of race or nationality or creed or culture. Because until you're called by God, you are a Gentile, meaning you are one cut off. But now you're talking about a time, as we already read in the very beginning of the chapter, or the first part, beginning in verse 28 of Joel 2. Remember, where that spirit's going to be offered to all humanity. So now there's going to be no more Gentiles. There's going to be no one cut off from God anymore. They're all going to be called. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. When all peoples have a chance to know God and to come into a close relationship with God, if they will, now you've got the ideal perfect society. And that is what Jesus Christ is going to usher in. So as we're going through this morning, keep in mind the original question, why keep the feast? A key reason to keep the feast is because of the glorious paradise which is coming to this planet, which is pictured by this very seven-day Feast of Tabernacles, according to the plan of God. Not only will the earth be renewed and the curses are going to be extinguished finally, but now you're going to have a new king that's going to be a blessing, a blessed government upon this earth for the benefit of all families. Is that something to be celebrated? You bet it is. Micah 4, verse 3. Micah chapter 4, beginning in verse 3. He shall judge among many people and rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. How significant is that statement? How much time and money do human beings today invest in war? I don't know how many billions, but it's a lot of billions. So a major industry, and it has been, human beings, you know, in order to pursue their lust and their greed and their covetousness and their desire to exploit, they go to war. To take it away from other people that they can beat. whether it's with clubs or swords or high-end fighting machines like we have today. And so a lot of the power is held by people who provide the means of the productions of war machines to fund nations, either to fight one another or else to posture against one another. We're talking about a time under the rule of Jesus Christ when all that goes away. There's going to be no more war economy, because there will be no potential for war, because the sovereign Lord over the earth is not going to permit it. And he's going to have all power, which means he can enforce his will, and he's going to do exactly that. So it doesn't mean that human beings are not going to have a desire in their heart to exploit and to take advantage and to rise up and to conspire and to go to war with their neighbors. Oh, they're still going to be carnal human beings. But Jesus Christ ruling with a rod of iron assures they will not be permitted to do that. He's literally going to prevent them from conspiring, let alone invading another land, which means there will be no reason for having a sword. So that is probably one of the great, beautiful prophecies that can make us all excited for the change in that government to come to this earth under Jesus Christ compared to what it is today. No war. No threat of war. Can you imagine children growing up in an environment where they never have to worry? So it's not just on the scale of nations fighting nations or family clans, you know, fighting other family clans. But you're talking about also peace from exploitation on an individual level. No more crime. No more theft. No more murder. No more assaults. Children will grow up never even thinking about that, because it will not be permitted by the new rulers. You won't have to worry about having your personal firearm for protection. None of that will be needed. Verse 4, but they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Eternal of Hosts has spoken it. So separately, we have a confirmation of personal property here. As Mr. Burke is going through the description of Babylon, socialism, communistic philosophy, which is absolutely anti-God. And yet here is a confirmation that in the millennium to come on this earth is going to be personal property, which the socialists vilify. Nobody should own anything. What do these European leaders say? You're going to own nothing and you're going to be happy. Yeah, who are they kidding? No, under the kingdom of Jesus Christ, every family will own a lot. They will have, first and foremost, they will have land, because land is the source of wealth physically. And just like he did with ancient Israel, all you got to do, if you want to get a glimpse of the way the structure is going to work on this earth under Jesus Christ, look at what he commanded under ancient Israel. They were just a physical nation, and yet when they inherited the promised land, what did God do? He divided them up into tribes, and then he gave every family of every tribe land. That was the reason they had the census. Those boring parts of the Bible that talks about the family names and the census and the counts and the number of everyone, that was in order to know how they were going to divvy up the land. No one was left out. God assured that every single family was given the source of wealth like to become a wealthy estate owner. It's not just for the elites. It's not just for a special few that get titles like, you know, lords and earls and barons and whatever else. No, every family of every nation on the earth is going to be a wealthy landowner. And so this simple statement, when it says every man, they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree. That doesn't mean you're a serf on somebody else's land working their land to get a wage. No, every single one of them is going to have their own property, their own orchards and their own vineyards and their own fields to produce crops and to produce wealth. And they will work for themselves to produce enough to take care of their families. That's God's design for the good of all families of all nations upon the earth. How much of a change is that going to be? Is that something to celebrate? Is that another reason maybe to look forward to the coming of the rule of Jesus Christ that we picture during this Feast of Tabernacles? I suspect every one of you would say yes. Let's keep reading. Verse 5. For all people will walk in everyone in the name of his God, little g, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Wait a minute. Jesus Christ is ruling now. Where are these false gods coming from? And it sounds like Jesus Christ is going to allow idolatry. In a way, yes. In one way, no. But in another way, yes. You know why? Where is the heart and the root of idolatry? It's in the human mind. It's the carnal mind that produces everything that's evil, according to God's plan. And these are going to be free moral agents. He's not going to turn them into robots. So these people in the millennium are going to be free moral agents just like you and I are right now. So yes, God, Jesus Christ, is going to enforce certain rules for society to maintain the peace and to prevent wars and to assure that there's no exploitation of neighbors, but he's not going to give us all frontal lobotomies. They're still going to have their opportunity and their responsibility to choose for themselves. So they may not be permitted to build pagan temples and statues to worship, but the idolatry is still in the potential in their own brains or in their minds. So what you're describing here is the fact that idolatry will exist during the millennium because human carnal minds will exist during the millennium. The potential by a calling, because all of them will be called, the question is how many of them will actually answer the call of God and choose willingly to take the steps that all of you are doing right now, instead of running away from that call to embrace it and then to make it your own. Some will, some won't. We don't know how many. I'm probably more pessimistic because I know how hard it is to overcome the carnal mind. I got one. How difficult is it for you, even once you know the truth and believe the truth, to do the truth? How easy is it for you to actually fight against your carnal instinct, your idolatry, your covetousness, your adulterous leanings, and instead to use the power of the Holy Spirit to do what's right? Hardest thing you'll ever do. Well, guess what? For the citizens of the millennium, it'll be the hardest thing they ever do. And some will do it, and some will not. Which is why this statement really here is talking about the fact that free moral agency for individuals still to choose and to have the accountability to make their own choice in this kingdom under Jesus Christ is still going to be real. Now, it's not the way the worldwide ministers used to talk about it when I grew up in the church, because it was all, I heard a lot more what I'm going to call Pollyanna type sermons, with the assumption that Well, everybody's going to be on board, because once Christ is ruling and everything is perfect and glorious and the earth is so wonderful, who wouldn't go along with it? Well, we found out through the apostasy of the 1970s that it's very hard for human beings to hold on to the faith once delivered and not to revert back to carnal inclinations. And the same thing is going to be true in the millennium. Because this is a proving ground where God will give man an opportunity to choose if they will. So he's going to enforce peace upon the planet and protect families and individuals against abuse or exploitation to give them every opportunity, but he is not going to take away their right or their obligation to choose for themselves. Which is why there's still idolatry existing in the kingdom, because there are human minds existing during the kingdom. Here, verse 5, for all people will walk, everyone in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. You're talking about the difference in those in the millennium who are choosing one way versus the other. Those choices will be going on. Verse 6, in that day, saith the Eternal, will I assemble her that halteth, meaning those that have disabilities, lacks, deficits of some kind. And I will gather her that is driven out, and her that I have afflicted. How has God afflicted them? Curses that come naturally upon those who break his law. Cause and effect. Verse 7, and I will make her that halted a remnant, and her that was cast afar off a strong nation. He's going to take the weak and the base and the underprivileged and the ones who have suffered incredibly because of sins either of themselves or their ancestors. And he's going to remove those curses and give them an opportunity to flourish and to be blessed. And the Eternal shall reign over them in Mount Zion from henceforth, even forever. How do you like that picture? Would you like to be a part of that kind of a society upon this planet? I always have to stop and say, but just take into consideration, this isn't really for you. Your hope, you see, is already to have been born into the God family, to be ruling with Jesus Christ, not the citizens, the physical flesh and blood citizens of the kingdom who this is describing will receive all these benefits. You're going to be spirit beings. You're not going to be given property that you need to work. You're not going to, you can eat if you want to, but spirit beings don't have to eat. You're going to have immortal life. You're going to have power to be anywhere you want to be, anytime you want to be. And you'll be given duties under the reign of Jesus Christ in order to manage your responsibilities, whatever those are. But this is from the standpoint of the physical human citizens who now are going to enter into their training program. Your training program's already going to be over. Either with a big thumbs up from God or a thumbs down one way or the other. We'll talk about more of that on the last great day. But if you and I are successful and we are a part of that first resurrection that we covered also on trumpets, then you will have a major part in this, but from the managerial side, for the benefit of the new trainees, the families, and the individuals who will be growing upon this earth. It's going to require a major work of restoration to put things back the way they're supposed to be. Go back to Joel 2 with me now in verse 21. Joel 2:21, fear not, O land, be glad and rejoice, for the Eternal will do great things. Be not afraid, ye beasts of the field, for the pastures of the wilderness do spring. For the tree bears her fruit, the fig tree and the vine do yield her strength. Be glad then, you children of Zion, and rejoice in the Eternal your God. For he hath given you the former rain moderately, and he will cause to come down for you the rain, the former rain, and the latter rain in the first month. How much of a blessing is mild weather? How much of a blessing is it when you get just the right amount of rain in the right time? Now, some of you have experienced, you know, in these recent hurricanes that we've had in affected areas, at least nearby where a number of our brethren are, you know what it's like to have flooding weather that comes in on the heels of a hurricane. That's not the kind of rain that he's talking about here, is it? So you're talking about another physical blessing and an aspect of the kingdom under Jesus Christ upon this earth. You're not going to have hurricanes. You're not going to have tornadoes. You're not going to have drought. You're not going to have floods. One of the things that he's going to control is the weather to be a blessing for all people. They won't have their crops destroyed by a hailstorm or have them dry up in the field because of a lack of rain at the critical juncture when those plants need it the most. Perfect timing of everything that is needed to make every family estate flourish. A bumper crop every single year is what it's describing. How would that be? Verse 24, and the floor shall be full of wheat, and the vats shall overflow with wine and oil. You're talking about physical abundance. It's not, we started off by reading in Genesis 3 where God said because of sin, he was going to curse them, and they're going to have to toil and fight and scrap for everything to get out of the ground, overcoming the weeds, the thorns and the thistles, and every other obstacle, including, it, in by implication here, bad weather. None of that's going to exist in the millennium. They're all going to be blessed and have super abundance. I wonder what the prices of food are going to be then. When everybody's producing their own, but there's leftover, remember, there's still going to be the system in ancient Israel concerning the priests. I don't know the details of how all that's going to work, but they're going to be ones that are devoted to the spiritual service of all the families of all the nations in every region who will be supported off the land, just like was commanded ancient Israel. So there is going to be sharing of excess produce and tithes and offerings. But imagine all these families having a superabundance that they're producing with reasonable labor, not having to struggle and to toil to their own physical harm in order just to eke out a living, but with reasonable work to produce abundance every single year. Wonder what the price of food would be. Be pretty low, wouldn't it? Verse 25, I will restore to you the years that the locust has eaten, so no more pests. The cankerworm and the caterpillar and the palmer worm, my great army which I sent among you. So God calls them his servants, his army, in the form of these insects and elements that actually work against man to destroy his work. And all that's going to be eliminated. Verse 26, you shall eat in plenty and be satisfied and praise the name of the eternal your God that hath dealt wondrously with you, and my people shall never be ashamed. And you shall know that I am in the midst of Israel and that I am the eternal your God and none else. And my people shall never be ashamed. That's a pretty glorious picture, isn't it? Worth sacrificing for so that you can be a part of it with Jesus Christ to bring it into existence in that day? Would you like to be able to see the families of the earth enjoy that kind of bountiful blessing? To see them develop as they make their choices and come to make their own decisions in order to embrace God and to follow him and to overcome their own carnal human natures and to put on the very mind of Jesus Christ. Wouldn't it be marvelous to be a part of that kind of glorious celebration? There's also going to be major world changes in topography. meaning all the maps are going to have to change. Let's notice a couple of texts there. Revelation 16, 18. Read this one on Feast of Trumpets. We'll just highlight it very quickly. Revelation 16, verse 18. There were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. We read this because this is in the run-up to the very end of the age when Jesus Christ is going to humble all of the nations and the people to put them in their place, and there's nothing like a huge earthquake that changes everything to scare humanity. Verse 19, and the great city, speaking of Jerusalem, was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. The cities of the nations. Now we're talking a global catastrophe. This earthquake's going to affect the entire globe, including Jerusalem, and it's going to change everything. And great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath, and every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. So I don't know how all that's going to change, but what I get out of this, if you've got a current atlas, do all of you even know what an atlas is? Most of us, we use our maps on our phones. An atlas is a book of maps. If you have a world atlas, it will show you a map for every region of the entire globe. And you can see where the mountains and the rivers and the lakes and the oceans and the cities, all of those are going to be out of date. Because what God describes in the run-up to the beginning of the kingdom of Jesus Christ, he's going to mess it all up. One, all of the cities built by human beings are going to be rubble. They're just going to be flat out destroyed. So if there are any particular monuments that man has built that you like or would like to see, like the Eiffel Tower, go see them now, because at the end of the age, they're all going to be gone. Washington, D.C., the Washington Monument, all that's going to be gone. None of the things that man has built that he thinks is so great, and we have a tendency to think is so great, it's all going to be gone, because it's all part of that Babylonian system of idolatry. I guarantee you, if human beings build it, it's got the curses that come from idolatrous worship involved in it. And God's going to level all of that. And by the way, he's going to change all the topography. It's not going to be the oceans covering 70% of the earth's surface anymore. The highest mountains like Everest are going to be brought down so that they're actually livable. It's not going to be all flat land. Some of you like flat land. In other words, you like the hills. There's going to be something for everyone. But it's all going to be different. Throw out the maps, the rivers, the courses, the waterways, everything is going to be different. Isaiah 11, verse 15 says, the Lord shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river and shall smite it in the seven streams and make men go over dry shod. So the water courses are going to be absolutely changed away from what they are today. The other thing we find out in this kingdom, uninhabitable places right now are going to be restored and made fertile. Notice Isaiah 35, verse 1. Isaiah 35, beginning in verse 1, the wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. There are certain places upon the earth, in fact, there are huge swaths of this globe that are desert, and they do not, people can live in them, but only with difficulty. All of that's going to be changed. They're going to blossom as the rose. You know, what's the one ingredient that is required in order to eliminate a desert? Water. So one of the things that God's going to do is literally bring a climate and an environment So the places on the earth now which are just sand or bare ground. Now, there's some who like the desert, and I get it. There's landscapes in the deserts that are beautiful and all that. So I don't know. You know, I don't know that all of that is going to be eliminated. But what this shows here is that from God's standpoint, making it fertile so that it can easily support human beings and their ability to live off the land and to thrive, that's where it's at. And that's what's going to happen here. Verse 2, it shall blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it, the excellency of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Eternal and the excellency of our God. Dropping down to verse 5. Then the eyes of the blind shall be open. The ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. So all physical disability is going to be healed. And then shall the lame man leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out and streams in the desert. And the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of dragons, which are like, you know, the lizards, and those things that scurry around in desert environments, and somehow they survive. But in the habitation of dragons, where each lay, shall be grass with reeds and rushes. That takes a lot of water. Isaiah 41, verse 17. Isaiah 41, 17. When the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue fails for thirst, I, the Eternal, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers in high places, and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water, and the dry land springs of water. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the shittah tree, the myrtle, and the oil tree. I will set in the desert the fir tree, and the pine, and the box tree together, that they may see, and know, and consider, and understand together that the hand of the Eternal hath done this, and the Holy One of Israel hath created it. That's another pretty expressive description of major changes that are going to take place upon this earth under the rule of Jesus Christ. Cities are going to be rebuilt and restored. I want to finish up here as quickly as I can, so pardon me if I rush. Isaiah 61, verse 4. Isaiah 61, 4 says, they shall build the old waste places, not just as they were before, by human beings and their deception and rebellion. They shall build the old waste, they shall raise up the former desolations, and they shall repair the waste cities, the desolation of many generations. Whose cities? Probably the cities of Israel, not the cities of Babylon. There were cities in Israel. They were godly ones. Those are the ones that are probably being spoken of here. Ezekiel 36, verse 33. There is a purpose for cities. It's not the Babylonian philosophy, though, like Mr. Burke is going through to show you the intention to exploit humanity by pushing them all together in a fenced enclosure so that they can be controlled, taken advantage of, and turned into slaves. That won't be in any way part of a godly city during the millennium. You know, there is a need for and a use for centers of commerce, like for trade, which are very likely going to be a part of the city structure. Remember also in ancient Israel, there were cities, and basically the Levites lived in the cities and conducted the religious work for their appointed areas. So that would be certainly, and also then for religious services, for Sabbath, holy day keeping throughout the year, bringing in tithes and offerings. There is a value for having a central hub, a place where people come together. But I guarantee you, a godly city under Jesus Christ can be very different from what you see today. There's not going to be some, you know, all this plethora of high-rise towers where you push in all these people into little apartments by the thousands. That's not the way God intended man to live. Ezekiel 36:33, thus saith the Lord God, in the day that I shall have cleansed you from all your iniquity, I will also cause you to dwell in the cities, and the way shall be builded, and the desolate land shall be tilled, whereas it lay desolate in the sight of all that passed by. And they shall say, this land was desolate, is become like the Garden of Eden. And the waste and desolate and ruined cities are become fenced and are inhabited. Turning a curse into a blessing under the rule of Jesus Christ. We also turn to Isaiah 11. Now we'll pick up verse 6 through 10, where we find is a part of the prophecy that I skipped over before. In particular, this says wild beasts now are going to become tame once more, like it appeared it was back in the original garden. Instead of animals upon this earth being a threat to humanity, like the black bears here in the Smoky Mountains, potentially, all that's going to be changed. Isaiah 11, verse 6, the wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. Not going to be a threat to innocent little children anymore. The cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The sucking child shall play on the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the cockatrice den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Eternal as the waters cover the sea. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. What a picture. That is coming. It's going to be real. It's not just a fantasy. It's not just a figment of someone's imagination. This is the statement of a purposeful God who wrote this Bible and said, this is what I declare I am going to do. It's going to become real. The earth will finally have rest from the curses of man's misuse for 6,000 years. All the inhabitants of the earth will finally come under the blessings of God, not just one called out nation. All peoples of all nations around the globe will have a chance to be blessed as the people of God. Final text, Jeremiah 31, verse 12. Jeremiah 31, beginning in verse 12, therefore they shall come and sing in the height of Zion and shall flow together to the goodness of the Eternal, for wheat and for wine, for oil and for the young of the flock and of the herd, and their soul shall be as a watered garden. And they shall not sorrow any more at all. Then shall the virgin rejoice in the dance, both young men and old together, for I will turn their mourning into joy and will comfort them and make them rejoice from their sorrow. Verse 14, and I will satiate the soul of the priest with fatness, and my people shall be satisfied with my goodness, saith the Eternal. So what is another key reason? You can answer if somebody asks you, why do you go to that religious retreat in the fall? Besides the fact you believe there is a God, you believe that He commanded it, you can also think in your own mind, even if you don't express it, because you keep the feast because you're celebrating the glorious paradise which is going to come to this planet, physically and spiritually, when Jesus Christ becomes its King.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented A Picture of Paradise, the third message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Why Keep the Feast, given for the afternoon service of the third day of the Feast of Tabernacles in Townsend, Tennessee, October 19th, 2024.